meters to go. This is message number 48 in our series through Genesis, entitled Carry Me Home. We'll be looking at this chapter, and I want to start with reading verses 1 to 4. Then Joseph came and told Pharaoh and said, "My father and my brethren and their flocks and their herds and all that they have are come out of the land of Canaan, and behold, they are in the land of Goshen." And he took some of his brethren, even 5 men, and presented them unto Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said unto his brethren, "What is your occupation?" And they said unto Pharaoh, "Thy servants are shepherds, both we and also our fathers." They said moreover unto Pharaoh, "For to sojourn in the land are we come, for thy servants have no pasture for their flocks, for the famine is sore in the land of Canaan. Now therefore we pray thee, let thy servants dwell in the land of Goshen." So chapter 46 that we looked at this morning gives us the last appearance of God to speak to one of the patriarchs in the book of Genesis. And it's little interruptions like that as we're reading along in this account, this story of Joseph in particular, as we look at the end of Genesis. It's these little interruptions like that, little theological comments that you get here and there that remind us that Jacob is living in a story that is God's story, and it's also much larger than Jacob's life and family. And Jacob obviously knows that as he speaks with God in that moment. And Jacob's movements, as we think about the famine and what it has brought about and how it has sort of propelled his family now to return to Egypt, Jacob's movements almost seem to be dictated to him, almost like there's no, he didn't really have any options, he didn't really have any choices, and so he's just doing more or less what he has to do in a sense. But God confirms his promises all the way back to Abraham, that he's going to bring Israel to sojourn in a strange land, he's going to make them into a great nation there, and then he's going to bring them out of that land back to Canaan, back to the land promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And so God confirms to Jacob that what is taking place is indeed a part of his plan, a part of his purpose. He doesn't need to fear to go into Egypt that he is forsaking or will be forsaken. Now the record of the move to Egypt in that chapter also includes another lengthy genealogy. And this one is of Jacob and his sons in particular, giving us an accounting of essentially that beginning of the nation of Israel that moved into Egypt and settled there. And a genealogy like that confirms that promises are being fulfilled. The seed of Jacob was indeed being multiplied. Now, ultimately, God multiplying Jacob's seed is to the purpose of making a great nation of many tribes from Jacob that, he promised all the way back to Abraham. And so the chapter builds up to that big moment that we've been anticipating for a number of chapters, that big moment when Jacob and Joseph are reunited after 22 years of Jacob thinking that Joseph was dead, having been mauled by a wild beast. So after 22 years of sorrow and 22 years of the prospect of mourning all the way to the grave for Jacob, Jacob confesses that he can now die and depart in peace, having been reunited, seeing his beloved son Joseph alive. Well, that brings us to chapter 47. And chapter 47 is something of a transitional chapter, because we're getting ready for the death of Jacob, which will be followed shortly in the narrative by the death of Joseph. And so there's a number of important things in these last few chapters of Genesis to wrap up. And so we're sort of being transitioned into that through chapter 47. And chapter 47 gives us an account of Israel settling in the land of Egypt. And the chapter focuses on Joseph. So he becomes again sort of this most prominent character. And it focuses on him and on his wisdom. We're brought back to the fact in chapter 47 that Joseph indeed is very powerful in the land of Egypt. And in fact, despite what the family dynamics might be with Jacob and his sons and what have you, in Egypt, they're subject to Joseph's authority. He is actually governor over the land of Egypt, second only to Pharaoh. And so we're brought back in chapter 47 to that realization that Joseph indeed is an extremely, extremely powerful man in the land of Egypt. And his family is truly in subjection to him, just like he had dreamed so many years prior to this. So there's a focus in this chapter on Joseph's wisdom in his continued administration of the people and the supplies of Egypt. And we notice that they prosper and that Joseph is highly esteemed. And there's an interesting reversal as you look at this chapter, because essentially Israel comes into Egypt sort of to fall upon the good graces of Pharaoh, you might say. But in the end, they're actually better off in their situation than the native-born people of Egypt. And despite that fact, all of Egypt still loves Joseph. And of course, that's foreshadowing what is to come in the Exodus when that situation becomes intolerable for those of Egypt and they begin to oppress and afflict them. This chapter 47, ends with the near-death announcement for Jacob. And the event itself doesn't happen for a couple of chapters, but nevertheless, we get the notice of it here. And it sets us up for the blessings that are to come to his sons in the chapters that follow, but also leaves us with a profound statement of faith on the part of Jacob and his desire not to be buried in Egypt. So as we look at this chapter, we're going to look at it in three parts. Verses 1 to 12, where Jacob meets Pharaoh. Verses 13 to 26, where we read of the ongoing famine in the land of Egypt and the effects of that. And in verses 27 to 31, where the end is near for Jacob. So let's begin in the first part, and let's read verses 1 to 6. Then Joseph came and told Pharaoh and said, "My father and my brethren and their flocks and their herds and all that they have are come out of the land of Canaan. And behold, they are in the land of Goshen." And he took some of his brethren, even five men, and presented them unto Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said unto his brethren, "What is your occupation?" And they said unto Pharaoh, "Thy servants are shepherds, both we and also our fathers." They said moreover unto Pharaoh, "For to sojourn in the land are we come. For thy servants have no pasture for their flocks, for the famine is sore in the land of Canaan. Now therefore, we pray thee, let thy servants dwell in the land of Goshen." And Pharaoh spoke unto Joseph, saying, "Thy father and thy brethren are come unto thee. The land of Egypt is before thee, and the best of the land make thy father and brethren to dwell. In the land of Goshen let them dwell, and if thou knowest any man of activity among them, then make them rulers over my cattle." So Joseph proceeds carefully according to the plan that he had given to his brothers in the last part of the previous chapter to inform Pharaoh and to present his family to him. And there certainly seems to be a very careful procedure that Joseph is following. And there's no explanation for why. So for instance, he chooses five of his brothers to go present before Pharaoh as representatives of all of his brothers and their families. And there's no explanation of why he chose five to go before Pharaoh, nor are we given any explanation of the choice that he made. Like which five brothers did he choose to go and present before Pharaoh? We're not told that either. So it could be that there were some sort of customs of court that Joseph was abiding by when appearing before Pharaoh. It certainly could be. But regardless of that, we are to judge from the results that Joseph wisely planned and arranged the meeting. So we're not told why Joseph did things the way that he did, but we are told particulars about the things that he did, the way that he went about it, and we're also told the results, which shows them to be successful. So again, the point is not necessarily why or what customs or orders of Egypt that Joseph might have been following, but the important thing is for us to realize that Joseph acted in wisdom, just like as he has been portrayed throughout this part of Genesis. So the brothers, they follow Joseph's instructions, and they claimed their occupation as shepherds. They were keepers of flocks and herds. In other words, they were keepers of livestock. And that was just completely the truth, and there was no reason to conceal that from the Egyptians, even though it was well known that the Egyptians despised shepherds. They despised herdmen of all sorts. They were an abomination to them. So they also request to live in the land of Goshen. Now, this is a reasonable request for them to make, and of course this is as Joseph has directed them, and it really accomplishes two particular things that are important. Number one, settling them in the land of Goshen will separate them from the Egyptians. Even though they will be in Egypt, they will have a land, a distinct land to themselves apart from the Egyptians. And number two, they can settle in a very rich and fertile land that will actually be conducive to the livestock that they keep. So you might say that those are two very good accomplishments for them. Now, Pharaoh does grant this request, but Moses also notes how that Pharaoh goes even further than what they asked. So he petitions Joseph to appoint competent ones of his brothers to manage the royal herds, so Pharaoh's own livestock. Now, I've read that it was not uncommon, actually, for the royal livestock in ancient Egypt to be kept by foreigners, because once again, these things were abominable to the Egyptians. They detested them and those that kept livestock and that sort of thing. All of that, they detested that. That didn't mean that they didn't have any livestock, but it wasn't uncommon for them to use foreigners to manage those herds for them. Now, this actually foreshadows how that this situation unfolds, that Jacob's family comes to be in a better circumstance than native-born Egyptians as the famine goes on and it increases in severity. So in other words, whether this was of any forethought on the part of Pharaoh or not, this actually sets them up to be in a better situation as this famine goes on and gets worse. Let's look at verses 7 to 10. And Joseph brought in Jacob his father and set him before Pharaoh. And Jacob blessed Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said unto Jacob, How old art thou? And Jacob said unto Pharaoh, The days of the years of my pilgrimage are 130 years. Few and evil have the days of the years of my life been, and have not attained unto the days of the years of the life of my fathers and the days of their pilgrimage. And Jacob blessed Pharaoh and went out from before Pharaoh. So we can see that this scene is quite a bit different from Joseph presenting his brothers to Pharaoh. The brothers come into Pharaoh. They are very respectful. They are very honoring of Pharaoh. They are very deferring to him. They refer to him to themselves as his servants a number of times. They make certain requests. However, Jacob comes in and speaks to Pharaoh more like a peer than one who was in great power and authority over him. And we're twice told in the account that Jacob blessed Pharaoh, which seems to be sort of upside down. Like Jacob should be the subservient one that is coming to seek blessing from Pharaoh, a little more like the brothers of Joseph. But rather than that, Jacob is the one blessing Pharaoh. So he didn't bow, he didn't make requests, but he blessed Pharaoh. Well, this blessing demonstrates two themes that we've seen going through the book of Genesis, particularly in this section of the patriarchs. And I would say that on the one hand, Jacob recognized his place in God's covenant and that he was heir to the entire land of Canaan. So in a sense, he's not subordinate to Pharaoh. In a sense, he's not below him. He has the promises of God going all the way back to the calling out of his grandfather Abraham from his native home in Ur of the Chaldees. So he is, in a true sense of the word, he's not inferior to Pharaoh. And also, Jacob recognized how Pharaoh had been, how Pharaoh had blessed them. He had blessed Joseph, obviously. He was blessing them as they come to settle in the land of Egypt. And he knew that God also promised to bless those that blessed Abraham and his seed. And so we can read the prosperity of Pharaoh through this lens. In other words, what we see through the promotion of Joseph is that Pharaoh only prospers and becomes even greater in the land of Egypt. And Egypt as a nation becomes even stronger as a result of him blessing Joseph and promoting him, as a result of him bringing Joseph's family down and blessing them and putting them in a land where they can grow and multiply and they can prosper. So in other words, we're seeing these promises to Abraham being fulfilled. And Egypt is being blessed because they are blessing Abraham and his seed. Now you notice in this interview that Pharaoh was obviously very interested in Jacob's age. And what we know of the ancient Egyptians, they were very serious about the study of life and death and the afterlife and long life. These were things that were of great particular interest to them. It was commonly believed among them that the pharaohs would acquire eternal life upon death. And so Jacob responds pertaining to his age, and Jacob is 130 years old when he comes into Egypt. So that means that he, at that point, was short of around 50 years from the age when his father Isaac and his grandfather Abraham died. Now, Jacob had 17 more years of life after this point, but he still fell short of their mark by a pretty good way. Now, Jacob speaks of the days of his life as being short and being evil. And it is common within Judaism to interpret the words of Jacob in verse number 9 as a confession of failure to honor his parents and to obtain long life, as is later promised in the Old Covenant law in places like Deuteronomy chapter 5 and verse number 15. Now, this would also account for the few and evil reference to his years. So is there an intentional allusion or reference to this, or is Moses drawing attention to this? I would just have to say that it could be possible. I don't see that as a certainty. But that, again, that is something that for a long time within Jewish tradition has been believed concerning Jacob's speech, why he emphasizes that his years have been few and short and not to that of his fathers. Then we look at verses 11 and 12. And Joseph placed his father and his brethren and gave them possession in the land of Egypt, in the best of the land, in the land of Ramses, as Pharaoh had commanded. And Joseph nourished his father and his brethren and all his father's household with bread according to their families. So the family is now fully settled in the land of Goshen, which is not entirely certain where this is, near to the Nile Delta, most likely. And we also see how that Joseph's dreams have come true when he dreamed about the sheaves and the sun and the moon and the stars and all of these things bowing down to him. We see that Joseph's family is truly subject to him in the land of Egypt. Once again, Joseph is a man of great power within the nation of Egypt at this time, and he's obviously in a position to do a lot of good for his family, and he does do so, but also he is over them in every sense of that word. Then we get to the next part here in verse 13 to 26. And verses 13 to 26, again, are part of that transition part, and part of that that is demonstrating to us Joseph's wisdom as an administrator of the programs that he set up in Egypt. So the famine is getting more and more severe. Let's look at verses 13 and 14. And there was no bread in all the land, for the famine was very sore, so that the land of Egypt and all the land of Canaan fainted by the reason of the famine. And Joseph gathered up all the money that was found in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan for the corn which they bought. And Joseph brought the money into Pharaoh's house. So the severity of the famine, as it continued to go on, the severity of the famine was leading to shortages. And Joseph is continuing his program of taxation, which he seemed to favor that 20% or that fifth part. I have read that in ancient nations within the ancient Near East, at such a time, that it was actually common for taxation to be more like a third, which would make Joseph's taxation program to be somewhat less and more favorable, and it could possibly be a part of the reason why that he was as highly esteemed as he was in Egypt. But I can't really know that for certain. So as the famine goes on, everything begins to run out. And ultimately, the people run out of money. And all of the money, it says, in the land of Egypt belonged to Pharaoh. Verses 15 to 17. And when the money failed in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan, all the Egyptians came unto Joseph and said, "Give us bread, for why should we die in thy presence? For the money faileth." And Joseph said, "Give your cattle, and I will give you for your cattle if money fail." And they brought their cattle unto Joseph, and Joseph gave them bread in exchange for horses, and for the flocks, and for the cattle of the herds, and for the asses, and he fed them with bread and for all their cattle for that year. So you also want to notice how that Joseph is doing business not just with the people of Egypt, but also with the people of the different nations of Canaan. So not only is he gathering up the silver of the people of Egypt, but also those, again, of the land of Canaan. Now, once the money runs out and the food is running out again, they came for food, and Joseph essentially accepted their livestock as currency to buy food. Now, obviously, this would have increased Pharaoh's livestock, and it would have also increased the business of his brothers who had been put over the royal livestock. And we read how that this continued on for another year. Verses 18 to 26 now. When that year was ended, they came unto him the second year and said unto him, "We will not hide it from my lord how that our money is spent. My lord also hath our herds of cattle. There's not aught left in the sight of my lord but our bodies and our lands. Wherefore shall we die before thine eyes, both we and our land? Buy us in our land for bread, and we in our land will be servants unto Pharaoh, and give us seed that we may live and not die, that the land be not desolate." And Joseph bought all the land of Egypt for Pharaoh, for the Egyptians sold every man his field, because the famine prevailed over them. So the land became Pharaoh's, and as for the people, he removed them to the cities from one end of the borders of Egypt, even to another, the other end thereof. Only the land of the priests bought he not, for the priests had a portion assigned them of Pharaoh, and did eat their portion which Pharaoh gave them, wherefore they sold not their lands. Then Joseph said unto the people, "Behold, I have bought you this day and your land for Pharaoh. Lo, here is seed for you, and ye shall sow the land. And it shall come to pass in the increase that ye shall give the fifth part unto Pharaoh, and four parts shall be your own, for seed of the field, and for your food, and for them of your households, and for food for your little ones." And they said, "Thou hast saved our lives. Let us find grace in the sight of my lord, and we will be Pharaoh's servants." And Joseph made it a law over the land of Egypt unto this day, that Pharaoh should have the fifth part, except the land of the priests only, which became not Pharaoh's. So eventually, just like the money before it, the livestock ran out. The people of Egypt had nothing left but themselves and their lands. And we're told how that Joseph bought up the land of Egypt and even the people for servants. But he gave them seed, so it's especially by common standards in ancient times, it was a fairly benevolent servitude, you might say. He bought up the lands and the people, and he gave them seed, essentially making them tenant farmers on their land, and they were tenant farmers for the 20% of the produce that would go back to Pharaoh, and the 80% would be theirs to keep. And Moses, of course, adds the comment about it being unto this day, showing that 400 years later, Egypt was still operating by the administrative programs of Joseph set forth before and during this famine. Now, there were two exceptions. We read of all this taxation, essentially, and there were two exceptions. The priests were one exception. This was the priests of Egypt. And they had sort of a government allotment and grant, and they were not required to sell out for food because they were taken care of because of their service to the nation of Egypt. And the other exception was the family of Jacob. The family of Jacob had land, and they were also keepers of Pharaoh's livestock, which was increasing throughout all of this. So in the end, again, their situation became better than the native-born Egyptians. And as they continued to grow and multiply over the centuries to follow this, this ultimately also led to jealousy and hatred of them by the Egyptians as well. But again, it put them in the position to be able to grow and multiply into the great nation that God had promised that he would make of them. And then we get to the last part of this chapter, and this is where the end is near for Jacob. Let's start with verses 27 and 28. And Israel dwelt in the land of Egypt in the country of Goshen, and they had possessions therein and grew and multiplied exceedingly. And Jacob lived in the land of Egypt 17 years. So the whole age of Jacob was 147 years. So just as God had promised, Israel multiplied. Israel grew. They grew in number of people. They became great in the land of Egypt. In other words, their prosperity, their success, they flourished in the land of Egypt. And this was before and after the famine, obviously, as they were 2 years into the famine when Jacob moved to Egypt with his family, and he lived for 17 more years. There was 5 years of famine and then 12 years after the famine. So in and during the famine, for all of this time, they were growing and multiplying and prospering. In other words, the famine didn't hurt them. Now, the famine, obviously, along with everyone else in the land of Canaan and the land of Egypt, was a great threat to them. But remember what Joseph said to his brothers, that God sent me ahead of you to save your lives. God sent Joseph to Egypt to save the nation of Israel. And not only are they saved, in a sense, from the destruction by the famine, they're prospering. They're growing, they're multiplying, they're becoming great just like God had promised that they would. And this is during a famine and in the years following. And so we're told that Jacob lived 147 years and he was nearing death. And so we're getting this near-death announcement for Jacob. Then look at verses 29 to 31. And the time drew nigh that Israel must die. And he called his son Joseph and said unto him, If now I have found grace in thy sight, put, I pray thee, thy hand under my thigh, and deal kindly and truly with me. Bury me not, I pray thee, in Egypt. But I will lie with my fathers, and thou shalt carry me out of Egypt, and bury me in their burying place. And he said, I will do as thou hast said. And he said, Swear unto me, and he sware unto him. And Israel bowed himself upon the bed's head. So Jacob knew that his time was near, and he also knew the promise of God that he would die there in peace with Joseph's hand upon his eyes. And he expresses his faith here by calling Joseph to swear a promise to him, not to bury him in Egypt, but to carry him back to Canaan. Now, the point is not that Jacob was just a sentimental old softy and that he was attached to the old home place and the old burial place, because they really didn't have an old home place, so much to speak. But there was a burial place, the Cave of Machpelah, that Abraham bought, and this is what he is referring to, where he wants to be buried. But his desire to be buried there is actually expressing a hope beyond the grave for God's promises to be fulfilled. In other words, it's alluding to the hope of resurrection, which Paul said in the book of Acts, upon one time after he had been arrested, that it was for preaching the hope of Israel that he had been arrested, and by that he meant the resurrection from the dead. So Jacob, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob did not receive those promises in their lifetime, but nevertheless, they will receive those promises. In fact, Jesus even spoke about how that people would come from the east and the west and sit down with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of the Messiah, obviously in this land that was promised to them. And this will be, of course, after the resurrection. So as we think about chapter 46, and again, it's a transitional type of chapter that's sort of setting us up and moving us into this very last part of the account in Genesis. The end of chapter 46 gives us Joseph's plan for meeting Pharaoh, and the beginning of chapter 47 gives us the actual meeting. And so you notice that there's a lot of repetition there. You know, Joseph gives this plan to his brothers and sort of spells it out, and then Moses gives us the account of them going and sort of acting out or enacting this plan. And so by giving us this sort of repetition, Moses is on the one hand showing us the wisdom of Joseph. In other words, we've seen Joseph as we've been working our way through this last part of the account. Joseph has made a lot of plans, and whether it was he's in Potiphar's house as a slave, whether he's in the prison as a keeper in charge of other prisoners, whether it's he's standing before Pharaoh and giving a plan in order to save Egypt because of the famine that is coming, whether it is the plan that he had to test his brothers concerning Benjamin and all of that, whatever that it is, we're constantly being shown Joseph having plans that were given details, and then it's almost like a repetition because the plans work out. In other words, his plans are successful. And again, we're not told any explanation for why Joseph took five brothers to go and meet Pharaoh and why he did things that way. But nevertheless, we're shown that it was a successful meeting. The plan obviously worked as Joseph wanted it to. So what we're being told about Joseph is that he is a man of wisdom. His plans are well conceived and they are successful. But there's also more than this. It also shows us that God was with Joseph and prospering him. And if you go all the way back to Potiphar's house in Genesis chapter 39 and verse number 9, that's exactly what we're told. God was with Joseph and prospering him. Now, on the one hand, Joseph thought and he planned and he sought to plan well, and he worked hard and he was diligent and he worked his plans, and his plans, again, were well conceived and they were successful. But it wasn't just merely Joseph's wisdom. It's not just Joseph's brains that are leading to all of this success, but it is the fact that God was with Joseph and was prospering him. So as we read this account, and Moses is drawing attention to these sort of things, how that Joseph has conceived of these plans, and these plans are executed and they are successful, then we shouldn't just think that Joseph is wise, though God has given him much wisdom, that is plain, but that God was with him and prospering him, much like the prospering of Jacob that we saw in the land of Paddan Aram much earlier. So it's a covenantal blessing that Joseph experienced through faith in God. It's because of God's promises. Now, even in the midst of severe famine, and we sort of go through the remainder of the famine rather quickly in this chapter, and we're not given a whole lot of details, but we read about the money of Egypt and the livestock of Egypt and then the land of Egypt and then the people of Egypt and eventually how they all come to belong to Pharaoh in a way that they had not before. So the famine is obviously very severe. And we keep reading, again, a repetition of how grateful the people are. You know, on one hand, you look at it and you think, you've lost everything. And they keep expressing gratitude. And they hold Joseph in high esteem. You've saved our lives. So they're happy for what has taken place and all of this prosperity. But even in the midst of this severe famine, we also notice over here in the land of Goshen, Israel is growing, multiplying, and becoming more prosperous. In a sense, the nation of Egypt is becoming more prosperous, but the people themselves are actually becoming more impoverished. They're becoming more in servitude to Pharaoh, and Pharaoh ends up with ownership of all of Egypt. However, in the land of Goshen, Israel is prospering, growing, multiplying, becoming great. So it is a demonstration of God's faithfulness to his word. And God's, we might say, sovereign ability to work all things together for good. Even things that seem to be against us. Even things that seem to be disadvantageous. Remember how the many expressions of Jacob prior to finding out that Joseph was still alive. All these things are against me. All of these things are working together to bring me to the grave in sorrow. That was the way that Jacob looked at it. And nevertheless, here they are in the midst of a severe famine where everyone around them, they're surviving, but Israel is thriving during this time. Almost inexplicable apart from the sovereign working of God and God's faithfulness to his covenant. Again, even though situations, circumstances do not seem conducive to this, they are nevertheless preserved and prospering.